He examined it with interest. It was one of those broad-bladed stabbing spears, the assegai which had been designed by the old king, Chaka, himself. Mark remembered Sean Courtney reminiscing about the Zulu Wars, Ishlandwana, and Morma Gorge. "They can put one of those assegais into a man's chest and send the point 2 feet out between his shoulder blades, and when they clear the blade, the withdrawal seems to suck a man as white as though he had his lifeblood pumped out of him by a machine." Sean had paused for a moment to stare into the campfire. "As they clear, they shout, 'Ngidla, I have eaten.' And once you've heard it, you'll not forget it. 40 years later, the memory still makes the hair come up on the back of my neck." Now, still holding the short, heavy assegai, Mark remembered that Chaka himself had hunted the buffalo with a similar weapon. A casual diversion between campaigns. And as Mark glanced from the blade to the great black beast, he felt his anger tempered with reluctant admiration. His anger was for the wanton destruction of one of his precious animals, and his admiration for the special type of courage that had done the deed. Thinking of the man, Mark realized that there must have been special circumstances for that man to abandon such a valuable, skillful, and lovingly wrought weapon, together with the prize he had risked his life to hunt. Mark began to backtrack the sign in the soft black earth, and he found where the bull had come up one of the tunnel-like pathways through the reeds after drinking. He found where the huntsman had waited in thick cover beside the path, and his bare footprints were unmistakable.
"Pungoshi!" exclaimed Mark.
Pungoshi had lain upwind, and as the bull passed, he had put the steel behind his shoulder, deeply into the heart. The bull had leapt forward, crashing into a ponderous gallop as Pungoshi cleared his point, and the blood had sprayed from the wide wound as though the standing reeds had been hosed by a careless gardener. The buffalo is one of the few wild animals which will turn and actively hunt its tormentor. Although the bull was dead on his feet, spurting blood with every lunging stride, he had swung wide into the wind to take Pungoshi's scent, and when he had it, he had steadied into that terrible, crabbing, nose-up, wide-horned, relentless charge that only death itself will stop. Pungoshi had stood to meet him as he came thundering down through the reeds, and he had picked the point at the base of the neck for his second stroke and put the steel in cleanly to the heart. But the bull had hit him also, before blundering on a dozen paces and falling to his knees with that characteristic death bellow. Mark found where Pungoshi had fallen, his body marks etched clearly in the soft clay. Mark followed where he had dragged himself out of the edge of the reed beds and shakily regained his feet. Slowly Pungoshi had turned northwards, but his stride was cramped. He was heeling heavily, not up on his toes, not extended into his normal gait. He stopped once where he had left his steel-jawed spring-trap, and he hid it in an ant-bear hole and kicked sand over it, obviously too sick and weak to carry it or to cache the valuable trap more securely. Mark retrieved the trap, and as he tied it onto Trojan's saddle, he wondered briefly how many of his animals it had dealt hideous death. A mile further on, Pungoshi paused to gather leaves from one of the little turpentine bushes, a medicinal shrub, and then he had gone on slowly, not using the rocky ridges, not covering or backtracking as he usually did. At the sandy crossing of one of the steep, narrow, dry-water courses, Pungoshi had dropped on one knee and had used both hands to push himself upright. Mark stared at the sign, for there was blood now for the first time, black droplets that had formed little pellets of loose sand. And in his anger and jubilation, Mark felt a prick of real concern. The man was hard hit, and he had once saved Mark's life. Mark could still remember the blessed taste of the bitter medicine in the black baked pot cutting through the terrible thirsts of malaria. He had been leading Trojan up to this point, to keep down, to show a low silhouette, so as not to telegraph heavy hoofbeats ahead to his quarry. Now he swung up into the saddle and kicked the mule into a plunging, sway-backed canter. Pungoshi was down. He had gone down heavily at last, dropping to the sandy earth. He had crawled off the game path, under a low bush out of the sun, and he had pulled the light kaross of monkey skins over his head, the way a man settles down to sleep, or to die. He lay so still that Mark thought he was indeed dead. He slipped down off Trojan's back and went up cautiously to the prostrate body. The flies were buzzing and swarming gleefully over the bloody bundle of green turpentine leaves that were bound with strips of bark around the man's flank and across the small of his back. Mark imagined clearly how he had received that wound. Pungushi standing to meet the charging buffalo, going for the neck with the short, heavy-bladed assegai, putting the steel in cleanly and then jumping clear, but the bull pivoting hard on his stubby front legs and hooking with the massive bossed and wickedly curved horns. Pungushi had taken the hook low in the side, far back behind the hip bone of the pelvis. The shock would have hurled him clear, giving him time to crawl away while the bull staggered on, fighting the deep steel in his chest, until at last he had gone down on his forelegs with that last defiant death bellow. Mark shuddered in the harsh sunlight at the wound the bundle of leaves covered, and went down on one knee to brush the flies away. Now, for the first time, he became aware of the man's physique. The kaross covered his head and shoulders only. The great chest was exposed. A loincloth of softly tanned leather, embroidered with blue beads, was drawn up between his legs, leaving free the solid bulge of his buttocks and the sinewy thews of his thighs and the flat, hard plane of the belly. Each separate muscle was clearly defined, and the ropey veins below the surface of the skin were like bunches of serpents, testimony to the man's tremendous physical development and fitness. The skin itself was lighter than that of the average Zulu. It had the smooth, dark, buttery colour and lustre of a woman's skin, but tight, dark curls covered the chest. "I baited for a jackal," Mark thought wonderingly, "and I caught myself a lion, a big old black-maned lion." And now he felt real concern that Pungushi was dead. For such a splendid animal, death was a shabby bargain. Then he saw the gentle, almost imperceptible rise and fall of the deep, muscled chest, and he reached out and touched the shoulder through the kaross. The man stirred, and then painfully lifted himself on one elbow, letting the kaross fall back, and he looked at Mark. He was a man in the full noon of his strength and pride and dignity, perhaps 40 years of age, with just the first frosts of wisdom touching the short cap of dark wool at his temples. The agony did not show in his face. The broad forehead was smooth as polished amber, the mouth was in repose, and the eyes were dark and fierce and proud. It was the handsome moon face of the high-bred Zulu. "Sakubuna, Pungushi," said Mark. "I see you, a jackal." The man looked at him for a moment, thinking about the name and the style of greeting, the language and the accent in which it was spoken. The calm expression did not change, no smile nor snarl on the thick sculptured lips, only a new light in the dark eyes. "Sakubuna, Jamele. I see you, O Seeker." His voice was deep and low, yet it rang on the still air with the timbre of a bronze gong, and then he went on immediately. "Sakubuna, Ngaga." Mark blinked. It had never occurred to him that the jackal might think of him by a name every bit as derogatory. Ngaga is the pangolin, the scaly anteater, a small creature that resembles an armadillo, a nocturnal creature, which, if caught out in daylight, scurries around like a bent and wizened old man, pausing to peer short-sightedly at any small object in its path, then hurrying on again. The two names, Jamela and Ngaga, used together, described with embarrassing clarity somebody who ran in small circles, peering at everything and yet blindly seeing nothing. Suddenly Mark saw himself through the eyes of a hidden observer, riding a seemingly pointless patrol through the valley, dismounting to peer at anything that caught his interest, then riding on again, just like an Ngaga. It was not a flattering thought. He felt with sudden discomfort that despite Pungushi's wounds and Mark's position of superiority, so far he had had the worst of the exchange. "It seems that Ngaga has at last found what he seeks," he pointed out grimly, and went to the mule for his blanket roll. Under the bloody bunch of leaves there was a deep dark hole where the point of the buffalo horn had driven in. It might have gone as far as the kidneys, in which case the man was as good as dead. Mark thrust the thought aside, and swabbed out the wound as gently as he could with a solution of acriflavin. His spare shirt was snowy white and still crisp from Marion's meticulous laundering and ironing. He ripped off the sleeves, folded the body into a wad, and placed it over the gaping hole, binding it up with the torn sleeves. Pungushi said nothing as he worked, made no protest nor showed any distress as Mark lifted him into a sitting position to work more easily. But when Mark ripped the shirt, he murmured regretfully, "It is a good shirt." "There was once a young and handsome Ngaga who might have died from the fever," Mark reminded him. "But a scavenging old jackal carried him to a safe place and gave him drink and food." "Ah," Pungushi nodded. "But he was not such a stupid jackal as to tear a good shirt." "The Ngaga is much concerned that the jackal is in good health, so that he'll be able to labour mightily at the breaking of rocks and other manly tasks when he is an honoured guest at the kraal of King Georgie." Mark ended that subject and repacked his blanket roll. "Can you make water, O jackal? It is necessary to see how deep the buffalo has speared you." The urine was tinged pinky brown, but there were no strings of bright blood. It seemed that the kidneys may merely have been badly bruised, and that the thick pad of iron muscle across the Zulu's back had absorbed much of the brutal driving thrust. Mark found himself praying silently that it was so, although he could not imagine why he was so concerned. Working quickly, he cut two long straight saplings and plaited a drag litter from strips of wet bark. Then he padded the litter with his own blankets and Pungushi's kaross before hitching it up to Trojan. He helped the big Zulu into the litter, surprised to find how tall he was and how hard was the arm he placed around Mark's shoulder to support himself. With Pungushi flat in the litter, he led the mule back along the game trail, and the ends of two saplings left a long, snaking drag mark in the soft earth. It was almost dark when they passed the scene of the buffalo hunt. Looking across the reed banks, Mark could make out the obscene black shapes of the vultures in the trees, waiting their turn at the carcass. "Why did you kill my buffalo?" he asked, not certain that Pungushi was still conscious. "All men know the new laws. I have travelled to every village. I have spoken with every Induna, every chief. All men have heard. All men know the penalty for hunting in this valley." "If he was your buffalo, why did he not carry the mark of your iron? Surely it is the custom of the Abalungu, the white men, to burn their mark upon their cattle?" Pungushi asked from the litter, without a smile nor with any trace of mockery. Yet mockery, Mark knew it was. He felt his anger stir. "This place was declared sacred, even by the old King Chaka." "No," said Pungushi. "It was declared a royal hunt. And," his voice took a sterner ring, "I am a Zulu, of the royal blood. I hunt here by my birthright. It is a man's thing to do." "No man has the right to hunt here." "Then what of the white men who have come here with their isibamu, their rifles, these past 100 seasons, asked Pungushi. "They are evildoers even as you are." "Then why were they not taken to be guests at the kraal of King Georgie, as I am so honoured?" "They will be in future," Mark assured him. "Ho," said Pungushi, and this time his voice was thick with contempt and mockery. "When I catch them, they will go also," Mark repeated doggedly. But the Zulu made a wary gesture of dismissal, with one expressive pink-palmed hand, a hand that said clearly that there were many laws, some for rich, some for poor, some for white, and some for black. They were silent again, until after dark, when Mark had camped for the night and put Trojan to graze on a head rope. As he squatted over the fire, cooking the evening meal for both of them, Pungushi spoke again from his litter in the darkness beyond the firelight. "For whom do you keep the Silwani, the wild animals of the valley? Will King George come here to hunt?" "No, nobody will ever hunt here again. No king nor common man." "Then why do you keep the Silwani?"
"Because if we do not, then the day will dawn when there will be no more left in this land. No buffalo, no lion, no kudu, nothing. A great emptiness."